Right, so we have covered all the preliminaries I wanted to cover. So something we had to do in order to be able to actually continue with the course. And I hope that, you know, most of it was just a review, but perhaps you learned something new as well. So now chapter two will be microscopic theory. Of phase transitions. And so let me start with this very vague and slow introduction. So part A, introduction. And so it is an experimental fact that matter organizes itself into phases, and these phases can be distinguished by different macroscopic properties. Okay, so matter organizes into phases, characterized by different macroscopic properties, but it was actually a great surprise that it's still described by the same microscopic Hamiltonian. Okay, so of course the examples would be. We can have solid liquid gas, so for example take water, although water is quite difficult to actually describe, but anyway, so it can be in the solid state, it can be ice, or it can be water as we know it in the ocean, or it can be gas as we evaporate it. And so if you are asking which macroscopic properties characterize each state, each phase here. So a solid has rigidity to shear. Rigidity to shear. Liquid, you can say it has a nice surface, but gas does not. Okay, so liquid, of course, that doesn't have any rigidity, so I can actually do whatever I want with this thing, and it will not keep its shape. If it's water, so water, liquid doesn't have that rigidity, but liquid has well-defined surface. But of course, gas does not. Okay, so the macroscopic properties are quite obvious, and you can measure some physical quantities which distinguish them. So another example would be a ferromagnet-paramagnet phase. So ferromagnet / paramagnet. And so the ferromagnet has macroscopic magnetization. So basically, we will learn that all spins can be considered, well, most of the spins are up. If most of the spins are up, you have non-trivial magnetization, and you are in ferromagnetic state. Okay, so ferromagnet has macroscopic magnetization. Whereas paramagnet does not. The last example I want to mention is the fluid and superfluid, so or conductor superconductor OMA matter. So we know that superconductor has zero electric resistance. In the same way as superfluid has zero viscosity, and expels magnetic fields. So it's the effect known as Meissner effect, and we have seen that it's not only superconductor, but also extremely black holes have the same property as discussed yesterday. So these are just, you know, a few examples how you have one kind of matter, let's say water, but it can exist in several phases. All the time, the water will be described by the same Hamiltonian, and somehow the phases have to emerge out of this one and unique Hamiltonian. And so that's actually something that people, that took some time to actually understand. People thought that you need a different Hamiltonian to describe when it is in solid state, a different one when it is in liquid state, and so on. But it's actually not true. You just need one. Okay. So now, the consequence, the fact that you can have different phases is a consequence of ordering, typically, at least in second-order phase transitions, as we will describe them. So there are other phase transitions which are not characterized by ordering, but I will basically not mention them in this course. Okay, so different phases, basically, different macroscopic properties. Properties are consequence of ordering. So for example, if you want to describe a solid, which has the rigidity of to shear, then this is, of course, a consequence of the fact that now we have ordered atoms in the crystal. Okay, so that's an example of ordering. In the same way, if you look at ferromagnet, then the fact that it has non-trivial magnetization, macroscopic magnetization, is the fact that the spins actually are aligned in one direction. Okay, so everything is a consequence of ordering. Spins in ferromagnet and atoms in crystal in solid, for example. Okay, so they're just examples of ordering and okay, so that's the basic notions we have to accept. So now, basically, the rest of the course, well, not really, but almost the rest of the course, will be just demonstrating second-order phase transitions on the simplest possible model, which is the Ising model. Okay, so canonical example for the rest of the course is the Ising model. Which, if you want, is the simple mathematical model to model ferromagnet and paramagnet, ferromagnetic and paramagnetic phase. So the Ising model actually is not due to Ising, it's due to Lenz. So developed by Lenz in 1920. But actually, the first solution in 1D was given by Ising. And so since then, it's called Ising model. So Ising
in 1925 gave a solution to this model in one dimension.
So it took 5 years to give a solution in one dimension. You will give it in your today's tutorial, so it's actually not that difficult. But then it took another almost 20 years to give a solution in two dimensions. And it's famous Onsager solution. So Onsager, 1944, solution in 2D. And actually, to obtain such solution is quite complicated. And you can spend the whole course actually just explaining this solution. So I will not tell you anything about Onsager solution. Okay, it's just, you know, technically so complicated that and not really eliminating in the end. So, okay. And of course, people are trying to find a solution in three dimensions. Mostly there are numerical results, but nobody knows how to solve this thing in three dimensions. However, if you move even higher dimensions, then it becomes simple. So 3D is ongoing problem. But in 4D and higher, it is simple again. And actually, the solution is given by the mean field theory approximation. So simple mean field theory approximation is exact, and actually you can give the solution if you want. Okay, so I'm not explaining at this point why, but towards the end of the course, you should at least have feeling why this may be the case. Okay, and so very approximately, you may understand this, that the problem when you are trying to solve these things is these fluctuations. And only when these fluctuations are not important anymore, then actually the mean field theory, which I will describe today what it means, actually is the right approximation. So what I'm saying here is that basically as you increase the number of dimensions, then actually the effect of fluctuations is smaller and smaller, and already in 40 is so small that you can actually neglect fluctuations and you are getting the right result. Okay, so now what is Ising model? So as I said, it's a model for ferromagnet and it's very, very simple. So you consider a d-dimensional lattice, okay, and then let's say I have lattice side I here, so d-dimensional lattice. Typically, people consider just the simplest lattice, so the square lattice. And then at each side of the lattice, you can have either spin up or spin down. Okay, so I have spin up here, I have spin down, spin up, spin down. Okay. And so spins correspond to spins are discrete variables. So sigma I, so I is the where on the lattice I am. So sigma I is just plus minus one. And so that's what the spin is. And then the Hamiltonian, as written by Lenz, is just basically you consider the interactions of the spin, and you're trying to align them to decrease the energy. So it's a factor minus 1/2, and then sum over I and j, and then gij, sigma I, sigma j. So you have two spin interactions, and the interaction strength is described by this Jij, coupling constant, and yeah. Okay, so that's the model. It's as simple as this. And as I said, so already in 2D, very, very complicated to solve. So now, this seems as highly idealized case, but in fact, what we also see later is that the Ising model belongs sort of to the same universality class as the transitions for water. So actually, once you understand what the Ising model is doing, you also understand what water is doing. Of course, you would like to understand this in three dimensions, and as I said, it's very, very difficult. But people who actually spend their lives studying Ising model, they motivate their life by saying, well, in the end, I'll understand something about water. Okay? Very good. So now, what happens is that typically for the Ising model, you have two phases, which is the ferromagnetic phase and the paramagnetic phase. And so these are distinguished by the order parameter. By order parameter. Which in our case is precisely the magnetization. And of course, the magnetization is just given by how many, what is the average number of spins up, basically. Well, yeah. Okay, so M is the average value of sigma I. So if you have a finite system, it will be just sum of sigma I divided by N if you have N points. And so you either have zero, which is the paramagnetic phase, or you have something which is non-zero, and that's the ferromagnetic phase. And so if you plot how this magnetization looks like, and you you can do it easily, as we will see very shortly, then you are getting a picture like this. So you have the magnetization, you have the temperature, and then there is some critical temperature here. And so the magnetization is non-trivial here, but it becomes trivial for temperatures bigger than TC. So now, so this is called critical temperature. So now, because the magnetization, which is our ordered parameter, actually is continuous through the phase transition, of course, the phase transition happens here. So I have either zero, which is this is my paramagnetic phase, and this is my ferromagnetic phase, this guy here. And exactly at TC, I have the phase transition. But because the ordered parameter at that point is actually continuous, this is called continuous phase transition. Yes, phase transition. So in the language of thermodynamic phase transitions, actually, you would find out that it's precisely second order phase transition due to Ehrenfest. But again, so what it means is that it's really called second order and higher to be continuous phase transition. So it's, yeah, it agrees with that definition before. And of course, notice that again here, the problem is that the behavior is non-analytic. Okay, so non-analytic behavior. So this again took lots of years actually for people to realize, because. Well, every physicist is taught that everything in physics is nice and smooth, and you can always have infinitely differentiable things and stuff like that. And so it really was a surprise that actually in nature, it may happen that it's not so, that actually you cannot always have everything analytic, and there are some non-analyticities actually happening in nature. Okay, so it again was a mind shift, which took several years. Okay, so now if you wanted to have a first order phase transition, then in the language of the order parameter, so just a note that if you wanted a first order phase transition, then in the language of order parameter, there would simply be a jump. So you would have something like this, temperature, and let's say I had, again, the magnetization, and then there would be a jump here. So it would be zero here, and then it would be something non-trivial here, but there would be a jump. And again, you can map this to whatever happens in thermodynamics. So you learn that in thermodynamics, you would have first order phase transition, when the Gibbs energy, the minimum of the Gibbs energy is actually continuous, but its derivative is not. The derivative typically related to the order parameter. So if you differentiate the Gibbs energy, you get the order parameter. And that's why there is a jump in the order parameter. Okay, so it's the same thing as in thermodynamics, but just in the language of order parameter. So now, is this clear? It's very simple, right? Simple. So now there's a beautiful symmetry in this Hamiltonian, so you can always map all sigma i's to minus sigma i's. So there's a Z2 symmetry to this. So H is invariant under sigma I to minus sigma I. Okay. So which is a Z2 symmetry, which seems as a simple observation, but in fact, actually, it's really, really crucial for the properties of this model. And as you will learn, that's basically all you need to know about the model, is that it has this symmetry. Once the model has this symmetry, basically all the properties will follow. Okay? So this is simple observation, but with far-reaching consequences. Okay? But so that's the symmetry of the Hamiltonian. But if you look at here, then I'm saying, well, the magnetization actually is such that I'm pointing up. Okay, so then you may be asking why I'm not pointing down. Anybody has an answer why you are not pointing down? Yes?
Symmetry breaking.
Very good. But can I be pointing down?
Well, it depends.
If that's
all you're including in the model. Like if you've got external magnetic field, you can.
But I don't have external magnetic field. So can I be pointing down?
Yes.
Exactly. Very good. So actually, I'm lazy here in the picture. Mm-hmm. You have equally valid other solution, which would be this one, where you would be pointing down. But the problem is that somehow the system, as I reduce the temperature, it chooses one of the states. I'm either pointing up or either pointing down, and that's basically randomly chosen. Okay. So this symmetry, which exists at the level of the Hamiltonian, is spontaneously broken as actually you decrease the temperature. Okay, so ferromagnetic phase, people say spontaneously broke. This symmetry.
Oh.
Yes?
Will we be doing numerical simulations of this with Lorin?
Sorry?
Will we be doing numerical simulations of this with Lorin?
I think so. I'm not exactly sure, okay. but I hope that something like this you will be doing. Okay. So if you want, what this word spontaneously breaking means that we basically randomly choose
randomly choose
up or down. And so more generally, this will be always true. So actually, the existence of the order parameter, the existence of this non-trivial magnetization, but more generally of any order parameter, is always tied to the fact that some symmetry is spontaneously broken. OK, so this is true more generally. So existence of order parameter is tied to spontaneous symmetry breaking.
Sir.
Yes.
I don't understand very well what we mean by when we say spontaneously broken symmetry, because, for example, we can have also translational symmetry in some Lagrangian.
Okay.
Also, like the particle will choose some a certain path.
Okay.
And here, like the description of one case and the other, they are the same, right? Although it chooses one path or the other, the Hamiltonian doesn't change in one case and the other.
Exactly, that's true. Yeah, exactly. So now,
what do you really mean by? So something happens that make the states not symmetric in this.
Uh-huh, exactly. And so basically, very roughly, this is a consequence of the fact that you have large number of particles, large number of spins. So of course, each spin or whatever is described by Hamilton's equations, each particle is described by Hamilton's equations, and you know that's deterministic, whatever. But here, if you have large number of spins, then suddenly this determinism sort of people say that, what do they say? That more is less or something like that? That more particles you have, actually the behavior is simpler, but it's unexpected. You cannot really expect it from the microscopic evolution, time evolution. So this is tied to that. So yeah,
okay.
If you have many, many particles, actually they behave in the simple way that, yeah, either in the end I have some average magnetization up or average magnetization down. But of course, it may happen, as I will just show in a very, very simple example, is that if suddenly, of course, each of these spins still fluctuate, right? So even if I am below the critical temperature, even if I am here, then I know that the average magnetization is this one here. But it doesn't mean that each spin does not thermally fluctuate. Each spin still does thermally fluctuate. But it's very, very improbable that all of them would fluctuate in such a way that suddenly you will jump into the sky. It's improbable, but it's possible. So in fact, you can still jump into a zero magnetization, or you can jump into the minus magnetization. But it's improbable. Okay? But yes, you can. So what I just said, so consider the following exercise. Which is very, very simple, but has far-reaching consequences again. So now we add magnetic field to this. And consider finite system. With n sides. Okay, so we have the magnetic field, and now we have n sides. So now the Hamiltonian, of course, is precisely as before, but now I also add an interaction of the magnetic field with each spin. Yes?
This is a classical model, right?
This is a classical model. Everything in this course is classical.
Hmm.
There will be no quantum, although it will look like quantum, but there's no quantum. Okay, so yeah, we will not discuss anything quantum. No, we will have something like Feynman diagrams, but everything will be classic. Okay.
So have they solved the like 1D and 2D quantumizing models? Or?
you can typically map them into the classical model in dimension higher. So 2D quantum model, no. Yeah. Okay, so we have n sides. And so I'm choosing this B to be bigger than zero. And of course, the magnetization is then just sum over n of all these sigma i's. Right? So that's what average now means. So I 1 to n. And then you may be asking, what is the probability that you find magnetization up versus the probability that you find the magnetization down? Okay, so now let's calculate the ratio, which is the probability that magnetization is up versus the probability that magnetization is down. And so now I'll be using the Gibbs distribution, or if you want, the Boltzmann law. And so you know that the probability is proportional to e to minus beta h. Okay. So now h, of course, for both these things is the same, but in one case, I didn't write the Hamiltonian. Sorry for that. So the Hamiltonian is now minus 1/2 ij, jij, sigma I, sigma j, and then it's minus b sum over I, sigma I. So now I'm adding interaction of each spin with the magnetic field. Okay, so now if you look at the probability, which is e to minus beta h, so this part is the same, so it doesn't really matter. But it will be the question whether these things actually are up in average or whether they are down, and you pick up a minus sign. Okay, so this is now equal to plugging this thing for the sum of sigma I, which is m times n. So it's e to minus n times m times b over t divided by plus n times m b over t. Okay, in one case I have magnetization up, in one case I have magnetization down. So this thing is just m times n. I'm just taking either plus m or minus m. Okay, so this is just the Boltzmann law here. Well, this is just e to minus 2 times m m b over t. Okay, so this is simple, but we can now consider two different limits. So in the first limit, I keep n finite, n is finite, and then I set b goes to 0, so I switch off the magnetic field. So if n is finite, I set b equal to 0, then I find that this ratio is what? B is 0, 1. Okay, so the ratio is 1. So in other words, actually, it means that as I average over time, I will be able to find, you know, equal number of time these things will be up, equal number of times it will be down. So over long periods of time, both states equally probable. And if that is so, then if I average over time, then the average magnetization actually has to be 0 in average. Okay? So this is for finite systems. So if you have finite system, then actually, yeah, no matter how improbable it is that I jump from here to there, it's happening. Okay? And that's, of course, jumping from here to there is exactly, you know, in the same average number of cases, and that's why the average magnetization, if I average over time, is 0. Okay, so this keeps jumping. So now you may be asking a different limit. So limit number 2, I'll actually take first that n goes to infinity. So this is called thermodynamic limit.
So n goes to infinity. And then, if you want, then you can take b goes to 0. So I just swap these limits. So now I have infinitely large system. So now what is the ratio in this case? N goes to infinity. So?
0.
0, very good. So now the ratio is 0. That means that one of these things actually is preferred. Okay, so system remains in a state previously defined by previous B. And so M is now non-trivial. Okay, so now if I have infinite number of sides, it will never happen that all of these actually swap and go here. Right? This is infinitely improbable that if you have infinite system, you can jump from one to another. So in the thermodynamic limit, actually you have the phase transition and the new phase stays there forever. Okay, but it's only in the thermodynamic limit. So this is just a simple illustration of a general fact. So conclusion, which is of course not proved by this thing, but it's just motivated by what I just done here, is that phases and phase transitions transitions are defined sharply only for infinite systems. Okay. So if you have a finite system, it's always a small probability that actually, yeah, it will jump back and that the average magnetization will be 0. So if you have So now, of course, you never have an infinite system. You always have a finite system. But if the system is sufficiently big, so as this thing here, then it will not actually decide to be something else because it's very, very improbable. So there's a very, very long time scale for which this guy actually wants to stay in this phase as it is. So macroscopic systems. Are not completely stable in that new phase, but have very, very long time scale for which they stay in that phase. Questions? Yes?
For a finite system, is the behavior then analytic?
Uh-huh. Very good. Yeah. So it is analytic, but almost non-analytic. Yeah. It's a good point. So strictly speaking, the phase transitions are only true if you have infinite system. But in practice, they actually happen. And they happen, they stay there for a very, very long time. Okay? So the phase is very, very stable. It's not the final word. There's still a probability that it will switch to something else. But yeah, it stays there very, very long. Okay, so that's basically what's happening with the phase transitions. So now I told you that the Ising model can be solved nicely in four dimensions by mean field theory. So now let's do it. So in this lecture, the rest of this lecture, and in the next lecture, I will show you how to use mean field theory to solve the Ising model. Okay, so part B,
mean field theory.
MFT. So if I ask you in the interview what is MFT, don't say me something stupid. Just remember what I mean by that, okay? So I just remembered my classmate, and so we were taking the English lessons, and so there was this like, on the whole, something is happening, or whatever. But he understood that like, on the whole, written as H-O-L-E. And so the question was, can you describe what on the whole means? And so he wrote the whole essay, what's happening when you are on the whole, actually. Okay, so mean field theory, MFT. If you start describing something else, I will not be very happy. Okay, so the main idea is, very simple. And so you see that we have these multi-particle interactions. In this case, you have two-point interactions. So now you want to actually get rid of these two-point interactions and just replace them with a one-point interaction with some average mean field. Okay, so idea is to replace all multi-body interactions with an effective one-body interaction action with an average mean field. Mean, and sometimes people also call it molecular. I don't know why. Field. Okay. So now what is actually interesting is that this idea is sort of equivalent to neglecting the fluctuations. Okay, so just accept it, and you'll see explicit demonstration of this fact that effectively this amounts to expanding the Hamiltonian H to the zero order in fluctuations. So basically, you neglect all the fluctuations, and then you will see that this is sort of equivalent to the statement that, yeah, I am getting rid of all the multi-body interactions. Okay. And so what is actually interesting is that I already mentioned that Ising model can be solved in four dimensions and higher by the mean field theory, but this is a general statement. So in 4D and higher, this is actually exact. Okay, so again, a statement which you have to believe me, but we will again motivate it why it is so in today's tutorial, actually. Okay, so this is what mean field theory is. So now let's apply this idea to the Ising model. Okay, so application to my Ising model. So I'll try to do the expansion in fluctuations. So I'll neglect the fluctuations. So the trick is to write sigma I plus something minus the same thing. So sigma I minus sigma I plus sigma I, definitely true. And we know that this is M and M, so this is sigma I minus M plus M. Okay, we have done lots of clever things now. So now this helps if you want to expand the term which you have in the Hamiltonian. So this is what you have in the Hamiltonian, sigma I, sigma j. And of course, it's just sigma I minus M plus M. And then sigma j minus M plus M. Okay, so definitely true. So now you multiply these things together. And so you have sigma I minus M, sigma I, sigma j minus M. That's the first two terms. And then you have plus M times sigma I plus sigma j. That's the terms linear in sigmas. Well, whatever. And then you have minus M square. Actually, so because you are getting minus M square, plus M square. So yeah, whatever. Okay. So now you say this is the fluctuations, right? So sigma I, so M is the average magnetization. And so now we are saying, well, at each side, basically, this is the difference against with respect to that average magnetization. Okay? So if this difference is small, if the fluctuation of each side is small, then this is of the order of epsilon. But now we have another order of epsilon. This is of the order of epsilon square if fluctuation small. Okay? And so the trick is to really forget this term and completely neglect it. So we are, you know, throwing away the fluctuations as they are. Okay, so then our Hamiltonian is just minus 1/2 sum over I and j, and then jij, and then I'm using this expansion, so I'll set this equal to 0, the first term, and then whatever is left is m sigma I sigma j, m sigma I plus sigma j, and then plus 1/2 sum over I and j, jij m square. Okay, so this is what the Hamiltonian looks like now when I neglect that fluctuating term here. Okay. So now, to simplify it further, you introduce a new notation. So you introduce j to be sum over I jij. So now, what is this? So these are the interaction constants, if you want. These are, and so you are summing for given j, you are summing over all these neighbors for which jij is non-trivial. Okay, so now in principle, this should depend on j. Okay, but what we assume here is that the lattice is uniform. Okay, so basically each side is exactly as any other side. Okay, so that's why this is independent of j. Okay, so independent of j. Of j, because lattice is uniform. Also, what you assume here is that this is a finite number. So now if you had interactions which would have an infinitely long range, then you would be summing an infinite sum. And it may happen that that sum you couldn't sum that sum, right? So you would get infinity. So here I'm assuming that only finite range of interactions. And then if the finite range of interactions, for example, I can interact only with the nearest neighbor or second nearest neighbor, but not with all the neighbors I have, right, in the site. So then this will be a finite thing. Okay, so once you accept this, then everything simplifies drastically. So first of all, this guy here, so if I use sum over I just get j, and then I have another sum over j, so I'll get n times j times m squared. Okay, so h is equal to, so now this is 1/2 n times j times m squared coming from this thing here, right? One sum gives me j, another sum gives me n, and so that's why that is true. So now if I do it here, of course, this guy has to be symmetric. Jij is a symmetric thing because why not, right? So interactions are okay. So now I sum, let's say, over, well, if I see I here, I will sum over j. Okay, so if I sum over j, I get j. And then I have sum over j and then sigma I. If the other term, I sum over I, and then I'll have sum over j of that guy. Okay, so they are exactly the same things, exactly the same contributions. And so what you are getting here is twice this. And so it's minus m j sigma I one sum left. So this is the mean field theory Ising Hamiltonian. And you can see explicitly, very, very explicitly, that we replace the two-point particle interactions with a one-particle interaction. So each side is interacting with some average field M. So we have one particle, one spin interactions only, interactions with mean field theory M, with mean field M. Questions? So you see, again, this is a explicit demonstration of the fact that in mean field theory, you are replacing many body interactions with one body interaction in some external field. Okay. No questions? I think it's very simple.
Sorry.
Yes?
Can you explain again why it's independent of small j?
Why it's independent of small j? I'm just saying, well, this thing actually is true anywhere in the lattice, but in every edge, anywhere in the lattice, I have to see the same thing, because I have sort of symmetry, translational symmetry in the lattice. Yeah, so that's the argument. Okay, so we simplify the Hamiltonian. Now we can apply the statistical physics machinery to actually calculate interesting quantities. So let's applying statistical physics machinery. The first thing is to calculate the partition function. So z is trace of e minus beta h. So now the trace is actually, so we have a discrete system, so the trace becomes a sum. And of course, it becomes sum over all possibilities. So you are summing over all sides and all possible spins in those sides. So it's a sum over sigma 1 can take plus minus 1, sigma 2 may take plus minus 1, and sigma n takes plus minus 1. of E minus beta H. Okay, I don't know if it really helps, but you can also write it as a, okay. So this H is just the sum of sigma I, okay? Just looks like this. So if you have exponential of these, it's a product of for each sigma. So, okay, so this is, okay, I'll just write it down and it'll be clear. So I equal to 1 to n, so this is just a help, but you can write all these sums in this simplified way of E minus beta H. So this is definitely true. I'm just a product of sums here. But because this guy actually splits into a product of exponentials, you can write it, well, let me write one more step. Sigma I plus minus 1. Then you plug in whatever the Hamiltonian is, so it's beta mj sum over, we have I already, so j sigma j, and then minus 1/2 beta mj n square. Is it true? Well, definitely not true, n. Okay, so this is what it is. Now you write this thing as a product of exponentials, and well, this is equal to that thing is the same thing, 1/2 beta n m square. I'm taking that out of the sum, and then product I equal to 1 to n, and then sigma I equal to plus minus 1 of E M beta J sigma I divided by T. Okay. Everybody happy? So now you can do this sum here. So sigma I is either plus 1 or minus 1. So you get exponential with plus exponent plus exponential with minus exponent. And so this precise the definition of hyperbolic cosine. So this is actually two times cosine h of the exponential. So m beta. Well, what the hell I'm doing here? Why do I have t and beta? Like that, mj over t. Okay, so that's that, and then I have product of these things, so it'll be 2 power n. So in the end, partition function is just given by e minus 1/2. And I forgot j. Sorry for that. There's j here as well. Nj m square over t. And then 2 times cosine h mj over t. And the whole thing is 2 power n. Okay. But when you do it in your tutorial today, I'm sure you will do it much better than I did it here. Okay, so that's the partition function. Now, the second step is to find the free energy. Out of the partition function. The free energy is minus T
logarithm of z. Okay, so now we will have two terms. The first one comes from that exponential in front of that. So it's n j m square divided by 2. And t cancels each other. And then minus n times t times logarithm of 2 times cosine h mj over t. So that's my free energy. And then you use the fact again, now you make a connection with thermodynamics. You know that the free energy is minimized for equilibrium. Equilibrium corresponds to minimize F. So now in this case, actually what is useful to minimize is respect to M. So I want to do df over dm. And then I want this equal to 0. So now, if you do that, you have 2 times this thing here. So njm minus, OK. So now we have minus nt, and then we have to differentiate logarithm is 1 over that. And then we have to differentiate cosine h, which is sine h. So then we have sine h over cosine h, which is tangens h. OK, so it's minus ng, nj, and then tangens hyperbolic mj over t. Okay, so we are minimizing the free energy with respect to magnetization here. And equilibrium happens in this case. So we are getting a consistency equation. Of course, n drops out, and j drops out. And we are getting an equation that m has to be equal to tangens h mj over t. So what this is actually, it just tells you how does the magnetization looks like as a function of temperature. And so if you use Mathematica or Maple, you can actually plot this thing. And what you should recover is precisely the picture I've been drawing. So this one here, M and T. So this is what you should recover. So let me just motivate it why you recover that. Pretending that we don't know Mathematica or Maple. So people typically plot these things graphically. So they plot whatever is on the left-hand side and whatever is on the right-hand side. Okay. So now we have to plot tangens h, and we have to plot m. Okay. So let's do it. So we have 2 possibilities. So one possibility is that the picture looks as follows. So I'm plotting m, which looks like this. This is m. And then, okay. So this is my left-hand side. That's function equals to m. It's just a linear thing. It may happen that the tangens h actually is such that it looks like this. Okay, so this is m, and this is tangens h of mj over t. And so this is one possibility. And of course, you see that the left-hand side equals to the right-hand side only in the origin. Okay, so then this is the guy which solves our problem. So now the other possibility, so this is possibility number 1. Possibility number 2 is that actually there is some intersection different from zero, so this is m. Again, I have now my function m,
but the argument of the tangents h is such that actually it has higher derivative here, and it looks like something like this. Okay, so this will be the tangents h. And then you see that you have three solutions, one here still, but another one here, another one here. Okay, so the first picture describes the paramagnetic phase, where we have only the magnetization equal to zero. The second picture describes the ferromagnetic phase, where we have three possibilities. We have non-trivial M. This is my non-trivial trivial magnetization. And then there is corresponding minus magnetization here. So let's call it M0. But of course, it's this guy is also possible. This precisely corresponds to the fact that, so this is the paramagnetic phase where I have M only possibility is equal to zero. And then in the ferromagnetic phase, I have always three solutions. I have this one here, which I call M0. Then I have zero here, and then I have another minus M0 here. Okay, so that's the second picture here. So now, when does each case happen? And so you see that what is really important is what is the slope of each of the sides in the origin, right? So whether actually the slope of tangent is bigger than the slope 1 for m, or if it's smaller. So now for that, you just need to expand tangents h of x is, in doing the Taylor series, actually x plus something, so x plus higher terms. So then the left-hand side is m, but the right-hand side, so in this case, the right-hand side is just mj over t. So now if j over t is bigger than 1, then the slope is actually bigger than that of the left-hand side. So we see that. So if j over t is bigger than 1, or in other words, j is bigger than t, then it's this picture. Okay. So this is j is bigger than t picture. And that's the ferromagnetic, so m is actually plus minus m0. And if j is smaller than t, then we have the other picture. Okay, so I'm comparing this with x, which is just j. So now I see that whether j over t is bigger or 1 or smaller than 1, that's precisely what decides whether I have picture 1 or picture 2. Okay, so in other words, you conclude that at t equal to tc equal to j, it's precisely when there happens the transition. So in our case, the critical temperature is precisely given by this constant j, and of course, you know, the strength. So j describes, you know, how strongly the spins interact, and so the critical temperature will depend on the strength of interaction. So this is the critical temperature. Sorry. Questions? Who hasn't seen this?
Really? Okay.
Okay. So yeah. So then it's for most of the people it's really trivial. I'm just doing this thing again. So how much time I have? Okay. So as I said, you can actually plot this diagram by using mathematical maple exactly. But already, you know, this discussion on left-hand side and right-hand side, which you probably first seen in your quantum mechanics course, already gives you lots of information. So we indeed would get a picture like this. Tc equals to j, and then the magnetization here. And this point here, which is precisely the phase transition point, is called critical point. Critical point. And because the order parameter is continuous, it's continuous phase transition or second order phase transition. So second continuous continuous phase transition. And what I tried to tell you yesterday is that these continuous phase transitions are quite simple because they are universal. So continuous phase transitions demonstrate certain type of universality. So now it will be up to next, basically next lecture to tell you what this universality means. And what it actually means is that different models have the same critical exponents. So I'll have to explain to you what a critical exponent is. Okay, so the next step is to the universality. Means same critical exponents. So critical exponents are just numbers which describe behavior of physical quantities near critical point. So critical exponents describe behavior of critical of physical quantities, physical quantities near critical point. Okay, so now there is a couple of these critical exponents. And what I would like to do today is I would like to calculate one of them, and then on Monday we'll calculate other. And then there are also some which I will not calculate, but I will tell you the result. Okay, so let me start with critical exponent beta. So exponent beta so that's not 1 over temperature, it's a critical exponent. And so what does this guy do for you is that it describes the magnetization, describes behavior of magnetization near critical point. But we know that the magnetization is actually our order parameter. So more generally, exponent beta will describe behavior of order parameter. So now we want to describe how M behaves near this critical point. So how, you know, how it starts going up, or you know, how it is zero here. Yes? You have a question? No. Yeah?
I have a question. So is an order parameter any macroscopic object that you set a constraint on, like you did in the Gibbs distribution?
Sorry, that doesn't constrain?
Is the order parameter any macroscopic number that you set a constraint on, like you did in the Gibbs distribution?
That's a constraint on.
Yeah. Like average magnetization equals something.
In the Gibbs distribution. Is it? I don't know. I'll think about it. Surprising question. Very good. I don't know. I'll have to think about it. So in our case, yeah, so order parameter is something which describes really your phase transition. What has to be ordered so that, you know, so which macroscopic quantity becomes non-trivial when you do a phase transition. So that's what order parameter is, right? So for example, for liquid gas phase transition, you could think about the order parameter as the jump in density of the liquid and jump of the density in gas. So you know that exactly at the critical point, they are the same. But then if you go to the first order phase transition or whatever, then that is a jump in these two things. So that will be the order parameter for liquid gas. Okay. So I don't think it's that precisely what enters the Gibbs distribution, but
yeah. Okay. It has to like change dramatically to be an order parameter, right?
If you want, yeah. It's something which characterizes your phase transition. Okay. So now if you look at this picture, it's obvious that M is small, close to the critical point. So that's why you can actually do a Taylor expansion in small m. So m is small near critical point, and hence you can do the Taylor expansion in that. So now if you look at the free energy, and people typically just discuss free energy per lattice size, so they divide by n, because then that n is not really important. And so we have that this is equal to jm square over 2, and then minus t logarithm of 2 cosine h mj over t. Okay, so this is what free energy is. So now this is of the order of m square. And now you want to expand this guy in terms of small m. Okay, so now you have to expand cosine h, but also a logarithm. So this is lots of work. So you employ Mathematica, and it gives you beautiful expansion, Taylor expansion in small m. And this expansion is given by the following. So then you find that f jm square over 2 minus 1 half t mj over t to power 2 plus 1 over 12 t mj over t to power 4 plus corrections of the order m to the 6, which are not interesting. And then you can put the terms which are m square together, and so you get that this is equal to, and then you can also use the fact that J is TC, is the critical temperature. So then you are getting that TC over 2, 1 minus TC over T times M square plus TC to power 4, 12 T cube, M to the 4, plus other terms. Okay. So just plugging J equals to TC, which is the fact which we derived right here. And so again, you see that in smallness of M, you have two leading terms. One of them, which is sort of indefinite, it depends on whether T is bigger than TC or smaller. So this will be either plus or minus. And then this is always plus. So then it's not surprising that if you plot F as a function of M, then if T is bigger than TC, well, this term is positive, so you just get a boring behavior like that. If T is smaller than TC, then this term is negative. It's winning near the origin, so you get something more exciting. So F and then M, and you get something like this. So now where f is extremized or minimized, you get the right thing. So this is precisely the magnetization m0 here, minus m0. whereas here the only solution is m equal to zero. So this is the paramagnetic phase, this is the ferromagnetic phase. So to find what these guys really are, that you differentiate f with respect to m and set it equal to zero. So, okay, so it's Tc 1 minus T over Tc, Tc over T times m, differentiating the first term and differentiating the second term gives you Tc 4, 3 T cube times m cube. Okay, and so this must be equal to zero. So you are getting a quadratic equation, however, a simple quadratic equation. So you can conclude that m is the plus minus, which is the m0, 1 minus t over tc, and square root of that. So this is how m behaves in the vicinity of the critical point. And so, of course, this guy, well, t is approaching tc, so this is almost zero. So that's why m is small. So people like these things, they call them small t. So t is just defined t minus tc divided by tc. And that's a parameter which goes to zero as you approach the critical point. So goes to zero as critical point approached. And so what you conclude is that m near this critical point, forget about that three thing, that three thing is precisely what is not universal about second order phase transitions. But it behaves like minus t to power beta, where this beta is 1/2. Okay, so this is a definition of beta critical exponent. So you are requiring that the order parameter, as you go close to the critical point, goes like this small parameter t to some power. And that power you call the critical exponent beta. And so this calculation shows that this critical exponent beta is equal to 1/2. OK. So that's the prediction of our mean field theory. So prediction of mean field theory approximation. And you see that nowhere in the calculation we have seen the dimensionality of the Ising model you know, to play any role. So this is independent of d, which is the dimensionality of Ising model. So you, in other words, you are getting that, yeah, there should be a phase transition for the Ising model in any number of dimensions. And in any number of dimensions, I should be getting that the magnetization goes like t to 1/2. And of course, this is not true. So this is only an artifact of the mean field theory approximation. And as I said, if you go to higher and higher dimensions, this will actually be true. But in lower dimensions, this is completely wrong. Okay. So here we go. So as I said, This critical exponent beta will be sort of true for many different systems undergoing a second order phase transition. And these systems are generically different. So this coefficient beta will be universal. However, whatever stands here, the square root of 3 or whatever the number you are getting there, that's something which can vary from model to model. And so that's not a universal feature. So the absolute value of m is not universal. But how the power in T to B will be universal. Questions? Yes?
So it's just the beta universal, or the fact that it's T to the beta?
So this is a definition of beta, but for second order phase transitions, you will find that the order parameter always behaves like T to beta.
Okay.
So this is true for any second order phase transitions. But what I'm saying is even more. I'm saying that many systems actually will have something like beta equal to 1/2, no matter what the system is. Of course, this is not true because beta 1/2 is not correct answer, but it's almost correct answer. For higher dimensions, it's correct answer. And so now I'm saying many, many systems in higher dimensions will have this beta equal to 1/2 and will behave like M2, T to minus 1/2. Other question? Yeah?
Isn't it surprising that many systems have the same beta?
Yeah, it is surprising. But of course, as you probe into this more and more, the surprise sort of diminishes, and then you find out that actually it must be so. Yeah.
But why?
Yeah, we will see. You'll see, don't worry. You'll see that. Well, not really, but we will motivate that. Other questions? OK, well, thank you so much, and see you in the afternoon.